Welcome everyone joining us here tonight on the Kings County Radio Club Technical Question and Answer Net. I am Roy, AC2GS, and I will be your net control operator for this informal net. I will be your host, and Malen KG2C will be your co-host on this exploration into amateur radio technology. The purpose of this net is to provide a platform for discussion and to offer our own answers and promote a conversation among all participants of this net. The club maintains an archive of these technical nets on its web pages. In addition, we offer original articles, reviews, and some topics covered during these technical nets. We also publish technical puzzles for our participants to ponder and as a starting off point to discuss important technical concepts. Tonight's TechNet puzzle is posted on our club website in orange-colored type with two periods displayed just above the link. But if you would like a shortened URL to find it, you can just type bit.to/KT2RC1. That is Bravo India Tango dot Delta Oscar /KT2RC1. In addition, we will be offering a streaming service for those who cannot receive our repeater signal. Just point your browser to bit.to/KT2RC. That is Bravo India Tango dot Delta Oscar /AC2RC. This net is scheduled for the second and fourth Wednesday of each month. All of this information can also be found on our club website, www.kc2rc.com. Members as well as non-members are welcome to participate, although we do appreciate it when our fellow hams join our club, and an application is available on our website. No question is too simple, no question is dumb. All wisdom begins with the asking of questions. If you have a question, it deserves to be answered. Our format tonight will be to ask for participants to check in only if they have questions or comments for this net. Please give us your name, your call sign, and whether you have a question or a comment. The net will then address each question in order. I will try my best to provide an answer, and Malen KG2C will join in. If any other listener has any further facts or opinions, they will be free to break in with a comment, with the word comment, and then recognize, offer their wisdom to us all. If you would like to contact the host of this technical net, simply address your email to tech@kc2rc.com. And now I would like to introduce my co-host for this net, Malen KG2C. Good evening, Malen.
Good evening, Roy. This is Kilo Golf 2 Charlie Milan. Very glad to be here, and I'm looking forward to hearing your guys' questions, and hopefully I'll be able to help answer them. And I'm also really looking forward to tonight's puzzle, which I think is very interesting and prompted me to review how industries work from the ARRL handbook, which is very detailed on the subject. So back to you, Roy, from Kilo Golf 2 Charlie.
Very good, and welcome back to good old New York City, Malen. He just came back from a vacation. So I open it to the net. Is there anyone out there who has any kind of questions or comments for the technical net? Please give us your name, your call sign, and whether it's a comment or a question.
Kilo Delta 2, Mike Delta Victor, name is Eugene, in Brooklyn, with a question.
Okay, you're first on the runway. Is there anyone else who would like to submit a question for the technical net? Sometimes people need a little bit warming up and other people don't get to the net quite on time. So we'll start with you, Eugene. What's your question this week?
Good evening, Roy. Good evening, everyone on the net. My question is about a coax switch. I have a Diamond CX210A, that's Charlie X-ray 210 Alpha. That's a two-position coax switch, which connects two radios to one antenna, and it has isolation of more than 60 dB. The question is it safe to operate one radio on certain frequency and have the other radio standing by next to it tuned in on the same frequency, considering a dilation of 60 dB. Back to you.
Well, all things being equal, I'm trying to exactly figure out what's going on. You have one antenna that's feeding both radios, I would assume. Is that exactly the configuration we're talking about?
Yep. It's two radios connected to one antenna via two-position coax switch.
Okay, very good. So the question is, can you leave the other radio on and not worry that your front end will get blown out? Is that what the point is?
Absolutely, 100% correct.
Okay, well, it's also important is how much power are you putting through that transmitter?
Typically it's about 5 to 10 watts, but it can go up to 50, so let's consider 50 watts.
Okay, so one would assume that the specs are legitimate for the frequency involved, and that's a little gotcha with many of these switches, that this isolation is quoted usually under a certain set of frequency ranges. But as long as you stay within the frequency ranges of the specifications, a 60 decibel is 10 to the 6th power, which is 1 out of a million. So if you put in 1 watt, that would be a micro watt out. So for, say, 100, that would be, that would be 100 micro watt. I think pretty much any radio receiver could handily deal with 100 micro watt. Again, as long as you stay within the frequency ranges. I once tried to use a HF a switch in the UHF band, and the isolation was unfortunately much worse than it was set for on HF. I think I found it to be some ridiculous thing like 20 or 30 dB of isolation. But I think with 60 dB of isolation, you'd be pretty well off. Anyone have any opinion on this?
Kilo Golf to Charlie.
Millet.
Well, without doing any specific measurements, I've been reading about the same thing, because I was thinking, how could I use my two radios that I have with the one antenna that I have on the rooftop without having to switch the coax cable, which is very annoying, on the back of the radios. And I wanted to have the same usage, basically, to switch between the two radios with the same antenna. And I basically started Googling to see if there's people doing that. Know, asking those questions. And I found that there's been a lot of people doing that and asking questions like that, and it seems to be okay, as long as the switch doesn't fail. Now, if, you know, the switch, the manufacturer might spec 20 dB isolation, but, you know, you might, if you have a way of testing, it would be better if you could test it, I guess, or, you know, ensure somehow with the first try with lower power to see if indeed there is enough isolation. But if it's working fine, I would guess that you wouldn't have any issues with it. Back to Roy.
Very good, Milan. I too agree that even if the specs would suggest that there would be no problem, that I would be cautious and try a lower power setting initially to see what happens. Again, it also depends upon the receivers that you're using. A lot of modern receivers have a lot of front-end protection against such issues. You know, if it gets a little bit too much that it can handle, it has protective circuits built into it. But I would try it at a lower setting and see how it went and work up from there. And I would once again always stay in the specified frequency range that the switch is given in, because just because it isolates very well at HF probably doesn't mean anything about its UHF ability.
And 2HOH.
Yes, Sandy, do you have any comments about this question?
So, yes, I do. I like to remove all doubt by using a switch that actually shorts the unused taps to ground, and especially for VHF, UHF. Those switches are available, and those are the type I like using for VHF, UHF especially. Like you said, HF is probably okay, but even there, I prefer to use the better switches until HUH.
Yes, well, I agree. If you can get one, it's much preferable to have the type that's around the other antennas. And very often that's what they're doing, even when they tell you that it's 60 dB of isolation. Part of that is it's grounding it. You know, you could just stick a couple of meters around and figure out exactly what it's doing. But I think often that's pretty much what it's doing. It's always nice to get an antenna switch, if you can, that does have a grounding position, especially when lightning is nearby and you don't want to go through the ultimate solution of disconnecting all of your antennas from the coaxial connections to your radios. The least that you could do is set all your antenna switches to the ground setting.
Yes, and some of them even have the that discharge tube inside that does another added level of protection, I guess. So, but you gotta. It's also helpful to remember to always put it in that ground position.
Yes, that's true. And some of the better made antenna switches have lightning arrestor gas discharge tube that add a little bit extra protection. I mean, it's always good to have your lightning protection on the outside of your building. You don't want to introduce any chance of lightning inside your shack. So, you know, it's kind of belt suspenders and maybe even a staple gun. But, you know, it's protection every which way. If you have any concerns about lightning, put a lightning suppressor on the outside of your shack and ground it well. Yeah, it's a very noisy signal. Is that you, Howard? Okay, very good. You have a question? We'll put you on the list. When we're finished with this one, we'll move to you.
I actually had a comment about this thing.
Okay, give us your comment. And if there's any way you could raise your power or move your antenna if it's on, inside your house a little bit, because you're about 50% noise, unfortunately. On the design of the switch. Most switch designs will switch the other device to ground, and that's where the 60 decibel of isolation really comes in. Others will simply disconnect it and leave it kind of open-ended. You can do it either way. It still, for all intents and purposes, terminates your reception to a great degree, you know, unless, of course, there's something faulty with the switch in which some of the signal bleeds through. I don't know if you've ever experienced it, but I've had people who, in the neighborhood, if they're transmitting, I can switch my antenna, my dummy load, and the signal is beautiful. So, you know, sometimes things that shouldn't radiate nevertheless. You're very welcome.
WB2YWB, WB2YWB, from WA2HKT.
mic?
That is I.
And who are you calling?
WB2YWB. Who is this?
This is AC2GS. We're having a technical mess this Wednesday.
Oh, sorry about that. My bad.
You're forgiven, Mike, and if you have any questions now or later on, you're free to ask them. So once again, I'm opening the net to any comments or questions regarding the situation or any comments from Eugene if we pretty much answered the question or if there are any aspects of the question that he still is having problems with.
Roy, put me in the queue for a quick question when you're done with the party now.
I will do that, Mike. So I guess back to you, Eugene.
KD2MDV. Okay, thank you so much for the answer. It really clarified it. So that's exactly what it is. From 200 to 1,000 megahertz, it has an isolation of 60 dB. That's the range. So I'll stay within that range and, if possible, turn off the radio just to prevent any leakage, if there should be any. And I also have an additional question, but that's after, you know, you can put me in the queue after HKT. That'll be about portables. KD2MDV, back to Roy.
Okay, very good, Eugene. So I guess we'll move up to you, Mike, WA2HKT. What's your question for tonight?
Thank you so much, Roy, guys. I was just wondering, Roy, I know this is a fusion repeater, which I do use on occasion. I was wondering if you know the approximate percentage of members of the club that actually have fusion radios.
Well, unfortunately, no one really keeps that kind of record, so we have about 50, 51 members. My guess would be that among the membership, maybe about 6 or 7 have fusion. I'll throw the question over to Milan because he has a fusion radio of his own and speaks on this repeater using fusion and probably has a better idea of the numbers.
I think it's at least 8 people. I think all of them are members, maybe most of them are members that use fusion regularly on this repeater. I've heard other people stop by on occasion. But those are, you know, the regular people I've heard, 8 people, I think, and maybe 6 or 7 of them being members. Kilo goes to Charlie, back to Roy.
Okay, very good. I mean, I'm sure a few of them are not quite members or not quite members yet. We have a new member from only a week ago who frequents our Fusion repeaters and works digital, and I'm glad he has joined us and is supporting our efforts because we use the money to maintain the repeater as well as other things. But, Mike, how do you like Fusion? What's your particular opinion, and have you used any other digital modes to compare it with?
Yes, Roy, WA2HKT returning. I've used the DMR. I've used the Fusion on this machine. I do plan on joining and becoming a member. And I've monitored the D-Star on my AOR receiver. So of those three modes, DMR is the most used digital mode in New York City. It seems to have the most repeaters dedicated to it. Fusion, I say, would be second. And D-Star coming in at a far third. I'm going to let it drop for 1 second, and then I'll finish my comment. Fusion, DMR seems to be a kind of a hurry-up, get-on-the-air, get-off-the-air kind of mode because you're tying up so many repeaters. Now, that can happen with Fusion also when you have Wires X employed, but generally speaking, Fusion seems to be a bit more user-friendly in that there's a bit more rag chewing that goes on. It's a bit more relaxed, a bit more casual. As far as the technical aspect, they all sound about the same to my ears in terms of quality. I prefer Fusion over DMR, and I really have not used D-Star, although I have monitored it. I think, you know, Fusion is probably the way to go for somebody looking to get into digital long-term. And that's about what I can add right now, Roy. Back to you.
Okay, very good, Mike. All three digital modes pretty much have a lot of similarities. They all use the Ambi vocoder chip, and that's the chip that compresses a person's voice to the smallest amount of bits that gets transmitted, usually using some kind of quadrature phase shift keying. You know, they're different enough so that none of them are compatible with each other, and yet they work on pretty much the same method. The only difference as I see it, and that's purely on a technological way, is that DMR institutes a time slicing technology so that it will send packets of 30 milliseconds apiece, and you can develop two separate temporal slots on a given frequency pair. And that's their way of, I guess, getting around this network versus local communication hub. One time slot usually is dedicated for the local conversation, and the other one is dedicated for the network hookups of North America and English and the TAC 310 and the other talking groups that are available. But, you know, the technology and the pluses and minuses of one digital mode tends to be very similar to the other. It's what you're used to. I believe D-Star was the most popular early on because it's one of the first ones early on, obviously. And it's kind of gotten a little bit tired and old, and people have been retiring theirs and kind of shifting over to DMR, which seems to be at a renaissance these days. I look upon the spectrum, and it's very easy to see something like five local DMR repeaters signaling simultaneously because they're all giving you the network feed. So, yeah, I would agree that DMR seems to be the top dog as far as popularity, but Fusion is growing every day. Yaesu was kind of smart in selling repeaters at dirt cheap prices and feeding the community with Fusion devices. It worked for us. We got a great deal, and they got to push Fusion.
Comment. We appreciate the information, and I would like to get down to a club meeting. I'm sorry I missed field day, but unfortunately I had to work. But I look forward to meeting you and the rest of the guys at a meeting coming up. I don't think I'll be there this coming Wednesday, but look forward. And I've used the Fusion side of this machine, and it works very well. So with that, Roy, I apologize once again for stepping right in the middle of your tech net, and I thank you again for your patience and your hospitality, and I'll turn it back to you. This is WA2HKT.
This is AC2GS. Well, Mike, you're very welcome, and the meetings are open to anyone and everyone every first Wednesday of the month. The next one coming up will be July 5th, right after 4th of July. We usually have our meetings at the New York Presbyterian Brooklyn Methodist Hospital. This time we will be having it across the street at a nice little building called Wesley House. That's 501 6th Street in room 6B. So anyone planning to come to the meeting next Wednesday, keep in mind, don't go to the executive dining room because they're still fixing that place up. So across the street to Wesley House and hit the elevator and go to room 6B and we'll all be there. So please, Mike, whenever you get a chance, drop on by the meeting and try and come to the technical net as well, because we can use everyone for their questions, their answers, their comments, and what have you. Now, Milan wanted to make comments about digital mode, so I'll turn this over to Milan for that.
Thanks, Roy. I just wanted to mention regarding digital modes. From what I've read and watched on YouTube, it seems that every metropolitan area seems to have basically centered around one digital mode, more or less. So for New York, and now it's DMR. But there's other areas who are still with D-Star. There's areas actually where fusion is the biggest thing. But I would say after the cheap Chinese DMR radios came out, DMR really has grown with leaps and bounds. But D-Star is actually also still growing, especially with once Kenwood released the D-Star radio. But a lot of the growth you wouldn't see in on your spectrum meter, because a lot of people are using the D-Star network not with radios that emit RF, but connecting directly to the servers with dongles. And that's actually how I use it. I have a D-Star radio, but I don't use it. I connect directly through my computer to the D-Star network using a dongle with the MB vocoder on it. And it works very well. It's a very, very popular way of connecting to D-Star, actually. And you can connect to repeaters that way that are connected to different rooms. Although they're not called rooms in D-Star, I'm forgetting the name right now. Reflectors, yeah, different reflectors. And with that, back to you, Roy, from Kilo Golf to Charlie.
Yes, very good, Milan, and quite true. It's a lot like Echo Link was and still is, that you won't pick them up on RF. They're using voice over IP across the fiber network, feeding into some repeaters and people. So there's Echo Link, and there's Wires X, and there's there are networks for DMR and networks for D-Star, and there are companies selling dongles. Some of them have AMBI chips that alleviate the need of a handy talkie. Others don't supply the AMBI chip and requires people to keep a handy talkie available using the transmission method of their choice. In other words, without an AMBI chip, if you want to get on the D-Star net, you have to have a D-Star handy talkie or radio in order to kind of leverage your internet connection. With AMBI chips, it doesn't have that limitation. You don't need any kind of a handy talkie or a radio. You can go right to the net.
That's correct. And actually, there is at least one dongle which has both methods, both with the chip and with the antenna, to give you the option of using whatever you like.
Yes, and we're still waiting for the mythological one radio that will rule them all, a radio that will be able to transmit on all the digital modes. We have radios now, general coverage radios, which were discussed in our last technical net, that will receive all the digital modes, but we have yet to come across one that transmits on all of them. And we're hoping that the DB4 mobile will not be vaporware, as the CS7000 turned out to be. But time will tell.
Very good, Roy. May I ask Milan a question?
Please, feel free.
Thank you so much. Milan, have you had any experience with Wires X on any of the fusion repeaters?
Yes, I have. I don't like it as much as D-Star, mostly because it's a centralized technology completely controlled from Tokyo. So if Yaesu's servers fall down, Wires X disappears, basically. DMR and D-Star are better organized in that sense. But do you have a specific question for it?
No, perhaps something that we'll discuss at a meeting in person rather than hypothesize on the air right now. But I was just curious as to what your experience has been. Thanks so much for that, and once again, I'll turn it back over to Roy. This is WA2HKT.
Very good, Mike. This is AC2GS, and once again, keep in mind that we are streaming this on the internet, so anyone who has a friend who would like to listen to us, it's bit.do/AC2RC, And after we're done with this TechNet, they can go to our website, www.kingscountyradio.com, and you can find an archive of this audio file just sitting there, along with the next technical puzzle for the following session. So let's go back to Eugene, I guess, and get his second question.
MDV. Okay, a little silly question. Basically, when testing two portables, let's say I'm operating on 5 watts, what would be the safest distance to be between the portables, just not to affect the front end?
Well, I mean, okay, so in other words, they're both plugged in, they're both live, and they're both doing receiving, and yet what kind of antenna wiring is going on? Are we talking again about the antenna switch, or are we talking about two completely separate radios with separate antennas being operated simultaneously?
The number two. Two separate portables with two antennas, you know, just completely separate. The distance between them, meaning, you know, whether I should step away 10 feet away from the portables or, you know, 5 feet or whatever. But two separate portables testing on using 5 watts.
Well, assuming that your radios are in good condition, they should be reasonably well shielded. So I would be less concerned with the distance between the two radios, per se, as I would the distance between the two antennas. Effectively, that's where you can either make or break the front end of a radio. I mean, just to give you an example of what works, I am transmitting on one radio, and about 20 feet away, I have another antenna picking up the signal from the repeater and what have you, that's working simultaneously, and I'm not frying my front end. So it's more important the distance between the antennas than the radios themselves. A well-shielded pair of radios can sit, you know, a foot away from each other, and it shouldn't be that much of a problem because you don't really have that much spurious emissions or reception.
Gotcha. But I'm talking about transmitting from one portable to another, just two portables, no other radios.
Okay. You know, there's no hard and fast rule, but again, I think the most important thing is not the location of the two radios, it's the location of the two antennas that you're doing the transmission out of one and the reception out of another. And, you know, if you keep in mind the inverse square law, if you separate the two antennas out of the near field, you know, a half to a full wavelength difference, for the most part, I think that would be enough that you wouldn't get too much of a problem.
Okay, Ray. Thank you so much. Back to you. KD2MTV.
Okay, very good. I'll throw it out to the audience and ask if they have any particular opinions of the distances they tend to use for their dual antenna systems. This comes to play very often during field day where there's a bunch of guys sitting in a shack someplace, I mean a real shack or a tent, and they're trying to kind of maximize their band usage without blowing out each other's radio. And you know, I've seen it not be that much of a problem for the most part. But if anyone has any insight, experiences, or comments, please feel free.
Over to Charlie.
Yes, Milan.
Oh, I haven't blown anything yet, but I have made some attempts here with running two HDs on 5 watts in the same room, and they definitely overload the front end of each other when they're in the same room with their antennas. So that way, let's say when I was using the repeater, I could transmit with one radio, but the other radio just wouldn't pick up the repeater because it would be overloaded by the first radio. So being in the same room can be too close if you want to listen to a repeater. Now, if you were doing it on simplex, just talking between the radios, they'll be fine. I don't think that will be a problem. But using a repeater might not work in that situation. But I think if I have them across the apartment, for example, which should be about 50 feet or so, separation with walls and stuff like that, that I know is not a problem. So, and you were saying 20 feet for you also was not a problem. So, you know, even in the same room, nothing got damaged here is what I'm trying to say, but it not, might not work for all situations. Back to you, Roy.
Thank you, Milan. And, thankfully, the front ends of radios are built very tough these days. And your biggest problem is going to be with too high power, you'll descent the front end and make it very difficult for it to pick anything up. But it won't do anything really serious and blow out your MOSFETs or such. If you have pre-amplifiers, there's some of them, the design, it depends on the design parameters, can be a little bit sensitive to too much power in the front end. But, you know, in most cases, that's not a problem. You get desensing and you get not a good reception as you should get, but you don't burn anything up. So, again, I would go for at least separating it by a factor of a few wavelengths so that you don't have to deal with the near-field effects, which are really strange. They are unlike what we take for granted of the far-field effects of antennas, and odd things can happen. So as long as you maintain that sort of a distance, you're usually good, with the worst-case scenario being desensing. So once again, I'll ask anyone out there if they have any opinions or comments about this question, any insight that they could add to it. Okay, a lot of noise. Once again, my default position is to assume that it is Howard. Is that you, Howard? Unfortunately, I didn't pick up anything on that time, and I'm even looking on the input to see if there's any signal, and I couldn't see anything. Whoever it was, please kind of check to see if you could gin up the power a bit or move the antenna around. Keep in mind, of course, that just because you found a spot where you can hear our repeater doesn't necessarily mean that that's the best spot for you to transmit, because both the transmitting and the receiving frequencies are different, and there's a slight variation in where the peaks are between the two frequencies. So you might find that going to the other side of the room is more beneficial. So keep that in mind when you're trying to get into a repeater when you just can't quite make it. That even though the sound isn't as good receiving, you might get better transmission. Once again, I will remind people that we have a TechNet puzzle. It's a puzzle about inductors, which is very important. You go try and use a radio that doesn't have an inductor, or for that matter, an antenna that doesn't have an inductor. So, if you have a chance, you go to the Kings County Radio Club's website at www.kingscountyradioclub.com and look for the TechNet puzzle and take a look at it. It's not a very long question, and it's not tricky at all. You could probably figure it out just by basis of logic alone without knowing what an inductor is and what it does, but it certainly does help. So please check out the TechNet puzzle and participate when we're talking about it later on. I will once again open the technical net to anyone who has any questions or comments for the net at this time. Welcome, Howard. Yes, what would you like to discuss tonight?
What can you tell us about the upcoming eclipse of the sun in New York? I know it's total in South Carolina, but what can we expect here?
Howard, it's my understanding that we will see approximately a 75% eclipse of the sun. And I sent around, I think, some information of different websites that go into it in detail. John, I think WB2FLU, came to the last meeting to discuss that. If you got the last newsletter, it's included someplace, the website. You can simply Google total eclipse and amateur radio, and no doubt you'll get a laundry list. So in the metropolitan area, at best, all we're going to get to see is 75%. And I must repeatedly request that people do not do anything foolish. Do not stare at the sun. You know, your parents told you this when you were a little child. Do not stare at the sun. You can blind yourself, seriously, permanently. Always use proper filters that are designed for this purpose. In the old days also, people would just take a roll of exposed film, and it sort of worked when the guys didn't blind themselves, and it didn't work when they did. So always don't do anything foolish. Protect your eyesight and protect your vision. Make sure if you're going to look at the eclipse that you get a filter that's designed for that purpose.
I was looking at it from the point of view of which bands might be open. Where should we be listening or transmitting? Regardless of the fact that we don't have a phone.
So your big question is will there be any propagation effects from the eclipse and any bands that will get better or worse? I don't think the eclipse lasts quite that long. In the last minutes was included a group of people who want to do radio astronomy experiments and tie in their results to a website and be able to figure out exactly what the eclipse will do as far as propagation effects. I wonder if they will be that pronounced given the fact that presently the solar cycle is coming to its low point, whether it's going to make that much of a difference having the moon in its way for a short period of time.
Okay, I got that. I'll just be listening to see if anything unusual happens. Just the most unusual thing that way is with a media. Something where you might hear a conversation for a few seconds.
Well, yes, but you're talking about meteor scatter with that, and that's actual radio bouncing back and forth, which some people do EME, Earth, Moon, Earth, Bounce. There's no particular benefit of doing Earth, Moon, Bounce related to eclipses, though. It's more of a factor of just what orbit the Moon is in and when is it closest to the Earth so that the radio wave loss from the inverse square law is at its minimum. But other than that, I don't think you're going to get any kind of pronounced improvements in moon bounce that you would see in meteor bounce because the meteors are much, much, much closer.
Got it. Thank you very much.
You're quite welcome, Howard. Does anyone else have any comments, questions, insights about the coming total eclipse? planning to view it in any way? Well, I guess we don't have any astronomers out there tonight. Does anyone else have any questions or comments for the net at this point? Okay, sounds like it's going to be a quiet night, but we'll persevere. Once again, I will throw out the general request. If anyone has a question, a comment, a statement, or anything that they feel so inclined to share with us on this technical net, please, give your call sign and tell us what you want to tell us.
WCA, Joe in Staten Island.
Hello, Joe, and what do you know?
Hello, Roy, and everyone on the net. Getting back to the eclipse. Yeah, I'm going to be out there with some welding goggles and some smoke glass, and I'll try to observe the eclipse.
Ah, very good. Just keep in mind eye protection. The eye you save very likely can be your own. But it's kind of fascinating to see that happen. It's kind of the good old days when you could go to some poor, unfortunate third world country and scare the natives. But it's still great scientific value. And even the post office is getting in on it. They have some very interesting stamps these days that use thermal ink that will obscure the face of the moon unless you put your thumb over the stamp, and then by the body heat of your thumb, it will cause the ink to become transparent and you can see the craters of the moon. It's a kind of a lovely thing for a little stamp.
Yeah, hot stuff. Yeah, I have the welding goggles, and Roy, when you were a kid, did you ever make an obscura to look at an eclipse?
You mean those lovely little light boxes?
Yeah, actually, we just used two pieces of paper, of course, one with a pinhole, and you had to hold them about 5 or 6 inches apart and line them up with the sun and move them in and out and eventually get a focus. It was kind of hard to hold, but it did work.
Yes, I have played with pinhole light boxes, and I went through a phase in childhood where I even went to the point where I built my own little dark room and did my developing and such. Even before I had an enlarger, I was fortunate that my parents used relatively large-sized film stock, and so I could make passable prints by just putting them in contact. But eventually I got myself an enlarger, and I did the whole thing in black and white. I could never afford the chemicals necessary for color, but optics is loads of fun. I would assume that a lot of people just kind of stopped at the point of burning ants with lenses and such, but those were great, those pinhole camera devices.
Yes, we had something like that on the job. I had told you I worked in a museum. It's actually a collection of 30 historic buildings. And some of the buildings are not open, and the windows, we have the windows covered with plywood. And one window had a small nail hole going through it. And at a certain time of the year, when the sun would set, you could see a whole view of the village and the cars going by and buses and people walking with hot stuff.
Yeah, optics is fascinating to me. And, sometimes when I squint to get things into focus, I remember all the little diagrams I was taught in high school physics and such. And it was a lot of fun. All those great lenses that showed rays going, diverging, converging, focal length. I got into taking photography after just developing pictures, and I got to play with all kinds of optics myself. And yeah, it's another science, just like geology and physics and chemistry. Optics is loads of fun. You can do all kinds of things with optics.
Okay, Doc, I just wanted to throw that in about the upcoming trip. Maybe we can get back on schedule now.
Okay, Joe, thanks for the comment. I appreciate it. Does anyone else have any questions, answers, comments, or whatever for the technical net at this time? Please push your little push-to-talk button and say your 2 cents worth. Yes, your 5 cents worth. Yes, Valen, what would you like to say?
Oh, I can ask a question if no one else has any questions.
Certainly, let it loose.
Okay, I wanted to ask about transverters, because I know you have a few, one or two, I think, and you have some experience with them. I was thinking, do you know if there's any real downside to using one of the cheaper transverters out of Ukraine, I think? There was a guy making much cheaper transverters, like half of the price of what you'd buy from the U.S. or Italy. Other than, maybe needing to set a little bit of an offset in the Flex software when you add the transverters.
AC2TS. Well, you're not the first guy to be tempted by those transverters. Initially, when I first heard about them and I read on the Flex forum, there were some positive notes because especially the price was certainly right. At the time, they didn't even sell an enclosure. You had to supply some kind of shielding yourself. The problems that I have seen with those designs are twofold. One is that they scrimp on the power module, so the final output is not really that good. And again, if you're interested in doing low power, it's not a problem. But if you're planning to, if you want to generate something more like a handy talkie, 50 watts, those guys aren't the guys. Another problem which is more serious in my mind is, and I don't know if they fixed it recently, but these things are inherently mixers. They take a fundamental, usually the 10-meter band, and they mix it so that the resultant frequency is the frequency that you want to use, either VHF, UHF, but there are other transverters for higher frequencies, although the higher ones usually use 2 meters as the intermediate frequency. And the problem is that once you mix it, you have to clean up the mess because you're going to have sums and all manner of harmonics. And if you cheap out on the filtration, it's a rather noisy, hashy output you put in. And I think that was one of the problems that some people complained about with their transverters.
Okay, thanks, Roy. Yeah, you guessed correctly. I was tempted by the cheaper transverters because, for one, I don't see why I would pay more for something that works even with cheaper version. And the other thing is I wouldn't, probably get much use out of it anyway because I'm planning to keep the 7100. But I figure it would be nice to have a transverter that lets me see the spectrum for 2 meters and 70 centimeters. All right. I guess I'll keep thinking about it. Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, it really does often come down to you get what you pay for. And sometimes it's a beginning market in a odd little country. Profits just to build a reliable name brand. But I think it's a little bit of both with those guys, that they're kind of cheaping out, unfortunately. But Most likely, you know, if they don't go under, they'll probably need to improve their the quality of their product over time, and it might be cost effective at some time. So, you know, you could always check back, and especially listen in to the people who've experimented with their dollars before you experiment. But transverters are loads of fun, and as I've probably annoyed more than enough people, I really enjoy looking at the pan adapters and seeing all of 70 centimeters and 2 meters in one visual are lighting up the because they're all outputting to their network feed, their talk group.
Yeah, the SeaBridge connecting them all and keying them up all simultaneously. Kilo Golf to Charlie, back to you, Roy. Thanks for the answer.
You're quite welcome, Milan. Once again, anyone out there who has any other questions or comments for the net? Okay, I guess we'll have a short night. We'll move on, I guess, then to the technical puzzle of the night. Very simple, not even a diagram. The question is, if a 9-turn inductor has measured value of 20 microhenries and the turns are squeezed closer together, the inductance might change to approximately, and then you're given four different choices. The first one is 20 microhenries, the second one is 22 microhenries, the first one is 20 millihenries, I'm sorry. The second one is 22 microhenries, the third one is 18 microhenries, and the fourth one is 10 microhenries. So, would anyone like to venture a guess on what happens when you take a air-wound coil that has 20 microhenries and squeeze it together? Okay, unfortunately, someone didn't give the repeater time to kick in, so I only heard the last word or two.
KD2MSU, Howard.
Yes, Howard, now I hear you completely. Yes, would you like to volunteer an answer for this technical puzzle?
Yeah. Mostly dependent on the turn, but I think if you move them closer together, something would change and it would increase by a small amount. And the answer is 22. But on a test, I might have answered no. Had time to think about it. I would say it increased the price.
Anyone else have any kind of opinions? Agree, disagree? You know, just want to say something? Anyone?
KC2WCA. Roy, I couldn't hear the station's answer.
Okay, Howard, KD2MSU, said that if you squeezed it together, it would cause an increase in inductance, a slight increase in inductance. So given the choices of 20 millihenries, 22 microhenries, 18 microhenries, or 10 microhenries, he thought that the answer was the 22 microhenries.
Okay, I think he's right about that. The equation has the length of the coil in the denominator, and if you decrease any of the terms in the denominator of an equation, the result would be larger. So I think he's right about that.
Very good, Joe. Does anyone else want to make any comments before I tell the answer? Like I said, it's not a trick one tonight. It's a good one to kind of brush up your understanding of inductors. but does anyone else have any comments before we give the answer? Very well. Both of the gentlemen were quite right. It does increase the inductance a little bit. You could almost use logic alone to answer this question, because you know, if you think of it, even if you don't know anything about inductors, the question basically says, I change something, and it either gets more, gets a lot more, gets less. So if it was less, the two choices for less are close together, and we didn't give you enough information to be able to tell how less it really was. And increasing by a factor of 1,000 is a lot of change. So just by logic alone, if you wanted to kind of trick out the question, you'd probably end up with the right answer being 22 microhenries. So it's 22 microhenries. The inductance is a factor of, well, there's basically four factors that make inductors work, and one of them is the length. If you make a coil longer, the inductance will decrease, and that also has a kind of logical understanding. If you consider that if you stretch out a coil enough, it becomes a straight piece of wire that has a very small inductance itself. And so you can pretty much figure out logically that stretching a coil is never going to increase the inductance, it will decrease it. So there's a lot of different ways to attack this question. The easiest, I guess, is knowing how inductors work and knowing that long equation. And by the way, if you, anyone is so inclined or curious, I will post the actual equation on the website, and you can see it. It has all kinds of very interestingly strange-looking constants and discussions of permeability and all kinds of wonderful things. But the bottom line is, yes, the answer is B, 22 microhenries, that the inductance increases a little bit when you squeeze it together. And that's why it's so difficult to predict the inductance of a device, because if you move it around, you squeeze it, you manipulate it, you might get it off spec. That's one of the reasons, if you've ever looked inside a lot of devices, very often they will dope the coils to lessen the chance of any kind of mechanical alteration of its dimension. And so that's my little 2 cents worth of inductors this week. Does anyone else have any comments, questions, answers about inductors?
Do you want to mention for a little bit why are inductors so important for amateur radio? So we'll go to Charlie.
Okay, we can do that. You have to understand that, capacitors and inductors are two very important devices for electronics, and especially for RF electronics. Capacitors store and release energy of a stored electric charge into a voltage potential in the flow of current, and inductors store and release the energy of stored magnetic field into a voltage potential in the flow of current. Inductances cause current flow to lag voltage potential, and capacitance causes voltage potential to lag current flow, and one cancels the other. Capacitance, by the way, is relatively simply determined by the geometry of the opposing conductive plates and the distance between them and the dielectric constant of the material separating them. Now, if you manipulate an inductor and a capacitor in just the right way, you set up a resonance that allows you to build all kinds of filters, high-end filters, high-pass filters, low-pass filters, band-pass filters. If you hook up a filter to a feedback mechanism, a feedback amplifier, you basically made yourself an amplifier. And so all transmitters use them. That's how we kind of get everything to run. So inductors are incredibly important, but just as important as capacitors, and they make this hobby possible. So if Milan has any other aspects of inductors he'd like to mention, feel free.
I just thought it would be good to give some context of why the question is important. Back to you.
Okay, very good. I mean, I hope that I made a case for the importance of inductors. They show up all over the place. They show up on filters, and filters are very important for transmitters to get rid of harmonics and mixers, and to remove spurious signals so that the signal of interest can be optimally amplified, and in transmitters to lessen the spurious emissions and the intermodulation distortions and such. They're all over the place, and your RF balun is basically just an inductor. You know, the cheap or the ugly balun that's a few loops of coaxial cable, or when you wrap it around a ferrite a toroid donut, that's also an inductor. So these things are fundamental to this hobby, and it's always good to kind of understand what they're doing. I have written articles about impedance, which is another topic entirely, which is kind of important to understand what impedance is. Inductors and capacitors have resistance to flow that's called reactance. Resistors have resistance to flow that's independent of frequency, called resistance, and reactance is highly dependent on frequency. And when you combine reactance and resistance together, you get a complex value for something that we call impedance. And of course, the most famous impedance is the 50 ohm impedance that we have decided to make the standard for amplifier outputs and coaxial cables, and that we tune most antennas to hopefully be close to, so that our viswas aren't bad and we don't get reflected energy back into our shack. This is AC2GS. Does anyone else have any questions, comments, want to make any comments about inductors or capacitors or filters or anything on their mind tonight? Very well. It seems like I'm active, you know, as long as we make it past the if they have any questions or comments for the net, I do the closing advertisement. Well, I do want to remind people that the next meeting of the Kings County Radio Club is July 3rd. The next technical net will be July 12th. I'll do it all over again. And we will be throwing a VE exam session July 23rd. Again, all of the club functions will be across the street from the New York Presbyterian Brooklyn Methodist Hospital in 501 6th Street, called Wesley House, in room 6B. Let it drop, and then I'll give you the ad. Net has been brought to you by the Kings County Radio Club. Our club is an ARRL-affiliated club based in Brooklyn. We meet on the first Wednesday of each month after 7:30 p.m. We offer a pre-meeting technical question and answer session, much like this net, from 7 p.m. to 8 p.m., as time allows. We have a weekly 2-meter club net on every Tuesday at 9 p.m. on this repeater, as well as a 10-meter net every Sunday at 11 a.m. on 28.380 megahertz upper sideband. This technical net meets on the second and fourth Wednesday of each month at 9 p.m. Members as well as non-members are welcome to participate, although we do appreciate it when our fellow hams join our club. And keep in mind that an application is available on our website. If you would like to contact the hosts of this tech net, simply address your email to tech@kc2rc.com. We maintain an active website at www.kingscountyradioclub.com or www.kc2rc.com, which offers archives of this TechNet, amateur radio news, original articles, and technical forums. Please visit our website and participate. And remember the words of the great philosopher Confucius, who said, "He who knows all the answers has not been asked all the questions." So keep asking those questions, guys. Well, it's time to roll this up and shut it all down for now, but we'll be back again on July 12th, and you're all welcome to join us. Thanks to all the people that participated tonight, and especially to Milen, KG2C. Without you guys, I'd just be talking to myself. So this is Roy, AC2GS, going clear and getting the heck out of here.
Thanks, Roy. Great job as always. Kilo Golf 2 Charlie, standing by and listening.
Thanks, guys. Great net. 73 AAP.